Late at night, I sometimes have a visit from David Hume. Pleasant, fun-loving, ironic, gentle David Hume. But he's not gentle with me. He shakes his finger and says, "If we take in our hand any volume of divinity or school metaphysics, for instance, let us ask, does it contain any abstract reasoning concerning quantity or number? No. Does it contain any experimental reasoning concerning matter of fact and existence? No. Commit it then to the flames, for it can contain nothing but sophistry and illusion." Well, ever since Hobbes put the scholastics into the kingdom of darkness, logical positivists, rational choice theorists, even animal rights activists give us humanists variants of the same bitter medicine. We are said to traffic in nonsense, unprofitable nonsense at that. How do we answer such challenges? How did our predecessors answer them? As we meet in July 2009, the climate is not good for the humanities. I speak from a United States perspective, but the worldwide financial disaster affects all of us. Universities that only 2 years ago were wealthy, ambitious, and ready to invest in new ventures are forced to cut back. And where better to make those cuts than in the beautiful, useless, and poorly defended disciplines that bring in few dollars for the institution? Journalists interviewing university presidents bring up with suspicious regularity the question of eliminating positions and programs, with French literature being the oft-cited and over-determined example. Because it's French. L'existence même de la France est pour l'Américain moyen une source de scandale. Proposals for disestablishing humanities and social science departments and replacing them with temporary, topically focused working groups are getting wide circulation. That has implications. When you dissolve a department, you abrogate the institution's long-term commitment to a field. Teaching jobs are already scarce and getting scarcer. Our students are frustrated and worried. If their joblessness is considered evidence of the moribund state of the humanities, the bad news forms a vicious feedback loop, a miniature of the larger credit crisis. And nobody, alas, is proposing saving our market with a massive infusion of credit. I have no solution for this problem, only a description. In the present climate, it does little good to talk about liberal education as the education of the whole person, the preparation of the mind for civic engagement, or the transmission of the best that has been thought and said, even if these things are true. Such arguments will be received as self-serving elitism, which is exactly the charge already leveled against us. Universities are asked to prepare students for careers. Where will those careers be found? Financially crippled universities are able to provide fewer career paths for young scholars. The very practices that we find most attractive and exciting, interdisciplinarity and comparative research, for example, are the ones least likely to open doors for a new entrant into the profession. So what can we say today about the humanities that will not be in the privative mode? Is the humanist just an educated person who is not a lawyer, not a physician, not an engineer, not a manager, and whose knowledge, being aesthetic or historical in nature, is not something that the marketplace is willing to pay for? How did we get to this point? Once upon a time, teachers of rhetoric and dialectic commanded a high price. Translators and cultural interpreters have not always been a drug on the market. But we are uncomfortable defining our disciplines in terms of utility. Utility means subordination to other purposes, and we are jealous of our autonomy. Oh yes, autonomy. That is the hinge of the talk that I plan to give, as opposed to the worried remarks to which I just treated you. To speak of the humanities as a branch of knowledge is always to envision them in relation to the whole tree, to the other fields of knowledge and the general plan of organized research. Whoever asks, what are the humanities, or what is specific to the humanities, is necessarily considering them in an ecology of disciplines, each striving for authority under the conditions of a particular historical moment, conditions in which what we call the humanities may be invisible or even inadmissible. Think of asking St. Augustine what he thought about the humanities. As a part of the city of man, they could only stand for forms of error encountered on the way to the city of God. Let the chapters of the Confessions on Education and Virgil be our witness. With Petrarch or Bacon, we might more easily embark on a conversation with mutually understood terms. But soon we would discover that whole realms and reaches of our humanistic disciplines were firmly anchored, for these late medievals or early moderns, in the certainties of nature, law, or divinity, and had none of the provisional, constructed character of humanities research. Or consider natural theology, a formerly philosophical discipline shunted onto the cultural and historical track by a Cambridge alumnus whose bicentenary the world has been celebrating this year. Unlike the trees in the forest, the tree of the sciences is apt to reshape itself at the trunk. Or perhaps the metaphor would allow us to propose that branches of knowledge may be sawn off one part of the tree and grafted onto another, where they may have better chances of flourishing. It is uncomfortable for a discipline to be defined by subject matter alone, for some other discipline may come along with a better or more parsimonious account of the same subject matter. Wilhelm Dilthey's formulation of the distinctiveness of the human sciences in the 1880s attempted to head off such reductionism. To summarize his discussion, whereas the sciences of nature explain by tracing effects back to their causes, the sciences of spirit, the Geisteswissenschaften, understand. They interpret the products of human activity, laws, novels, cathedrals, family structures, and so on, as expressions of intention and responses to lived situations. Nature does not need to be understood in this technical sense because it is not purposive, it has no subjectivity, and attempting to find sympathy with its agents will get you nowhere. But you would fall short of accounting for any human act if you framed it merely as the consequence of a prior cause, says Dilthey. It is purposes and perspectives that plot out what humans are apt to do in the world. For this reason, Dilthey is hailed as the second great figure after Schleiermacher in the genealogy of hermeneutics. If he is right about the human sciences, their main and perpetual task is interpretation. Now, I like this distinction between explaining and understanding. It's helpful for accounting for the oddity of our usual practices in a context of largely instrumental reason. We aren't trying to explain our objects, much less explain them away most of the time. The world will not be better for us when they have been reduced to their prior causes, right? So it's useful to be able to point to the distinction that Dilthey is making. However, Dilthey's distinction between understanding and explaining is offered at a particular historical juncture and is normative in character. We'll pin it down to the 1880s and try to see what sense that makes. It is not a retrospective clarification of everything that had been done before. In fact, the gesture of interpreting or understanding, as Dilthey understands it, is foreign to some of the main texts in the history of the literary humanities, among which I might cite, troping on Michael Wood's talk just a moment ago, Aristotle's Poetics. Aristotle is utterly uninterested in what Sophocles or Aeschylus had to say, what they expressed in their tragedies. He is only concerned to explain the devices that work to produce the tragic feelings of pity and fear, and to rank them in the order of their effectiveness. Some general views about human passions and motivations emerge, but they are obiter dicta, uttered only to set up the conditions for the dramatic effect that Aristotle wants to account for. Although Aristotle is our great source for the theory of tragic identification and catharsis, he is not participating in them as he writes the Poetics. His stance is rather Brechtian, we might say, anachronistically, that of the natural scientist or the engineer. Or consider linguistics, for example, the neo-grammarian kind that in Dilthey's day had recently achieved some impressive results. Phonetic changes, these linguists held, were blind, non-purposive, and they held without exception. There was nothing there to understand, though the mechanisms of sound change could be described elegantly and persuasively. So, interpretation is not the whole game in the humanities. There is much apart from it that goes on in departments dedicated to analyzing the products of culture, and Dilthey, of course, was aware of that. Dilthey, however, embraces identification as the first step in legitimating the disciplines of culture and separating them off from the sciences of nature. Near the beginning of his unfinished Introduction to the Human Sciences, of which the first volume was published in 1883, we read the following characterization of the star actor in the humanistic disciplines. Long quotation begins. Even before he is concerned to investigate the origin of the human spirit, man finds within his self-consciousness a sovereignty of the will, a responsibility for actions, a capacity for subjecting everything to thought, and for resisting from within the stronghold of his personal freedom any and every encroachment. This differentiates him from the rest of nature. He exists in nature as a realm within a realm. Thus, from the realm of nature, he distinguishes a realm of history in which, amid the objective necessity of nature, freedom is manifested at countless points. Thus far, Diltai. Self-consciousness distinguishes a realm of history from a realm of nature and subjects everything to thought in the name of the personal freedom of man. I'm going to stick with the dated and gendered language to remind us that we're dealing with a historical document. In other words, man accomplishes by a mere act of will the division of the human sciences from the natural sciences that Diltai is here proposing as a methodological guideline. But this act of will could lack cognitive support. Man could be wrong about his special status of exemption from objective necessity. At the very least, the legitimacy of the imperium in imperio, that is human freedom, nowhere comes up for scrutiny in Diltai's book. It is a fact about humans that they believe that they are not subject to the general causal determinism of the universe and act in a way consonant with that belief, but none of that makes it true. Understanding the human desire to be distinct from nature is perhaps exactly what is not needed here, because the desire is simply endorsed and thereupon left without an explanation, without a rationale or a legitimation. This bears a certain resemblance to the situation I mentioned earlier, where we think we are expressing the virtues of our field, and the people outside of our field think of us as self-serving. Right? Certain resemblance there. The methodological specificity of the human sciences then starts for Diltai with an identification of those sciences with a particular point of view, that of human will. These sciences are partisan from the outset, as their interests are bound up with the interests of their object. And of course, the interests of humanity sounds rather grand, right? We like that. A more cynical reading of this gesture of emancipation is possible, and I will indulge it. The humanities live in the shadow and under the threat of determinism, and resist it by rallying around the nobility of the human spirit, which is, by definition, exempt from exhaustive, reductive, natural causation. But an exemption, by definition, sounds like begging the question. When Diltai wrote, he had in mind a competing model of the interrelations of the sciences, that offered by Comte and Mill. I will quote from his historical summary. In the spirit of 18th century French philosophy, Comte's sociology subordinated the historical world to the system of the natural sciences. In Comte's view, the study of the human mind is dependent on the science of biology, and the uniformity that can be detected in a succession of mental states is the effect of uniformities of bodily states. Thus, he denies that lawful relations among psychic states can be studied by themselves. To the logical relationship of dependence that exists between one science and another, there corresponds, according to Kant, the sequential historical order which determines the relative importance of the social sciences. Since sociology presupposes the truths of all the natural sciences, only in their wake does it attain its maturity, thus far Diltai. The main point being that for Kant, we have to wait for the natural sciences to be complete, and then they can tell us what was the case about the social sciences all along. Right? But meanwhile, we're simply waiting for the natural sciences to give us an account of brain function and so forth that will satisfy all our questions, but not from within our own humanistic realm. For Kant, the order of the sciences was pyramidal and monolithic, a real chain of command. Mill's effort to subordinate the moral sciences to the logic of the natural sciences is for Diltai a weakened version of the same bold, if mistaken, relation to the natural sciences. Exempting human mental and social experience from the covering law of natural causality, in other words, the work of establishing the separateness and specificity of the Geisteswissenschaften, is meant to correct this mistake. Diltai goes into more detail about the unverified premises of Kant's hierarchy, quoting again. Underlying the subordination of mental phenomena to the system of natural sciences, there are two assumptions, one of which is unprovable, the other manifestly false. The assumption that psychic states are exclusively conditioned by physiological ones is a precipitate inference from evidence which, according to the judgment of unprejudiced physiologists themselves, is insufficient to base a decision. Diltai here cites Eduard Hitzig and Wilhelm Wundt. The assertion that inner perception as such is impossible and unproductive, and that the attempt to study it is an undertaking that our descendants will someday see presented on the stage for their amusement, is mistakenly inferred from a misconception of the perceptual process and will be fully refuted. End of quotation. I don't think Diltai ever gets around to refuting that, but that's okay. Now, this paragraph from Diltai makes a prediction, a credit call, on the results of future scientific investigation. Do we know that psychic states are exclusively conditioned by physiological ones? No. The matter is still under debate in our age of neuroscience. But the limits that Diltai's spokesman for the scientific side, Hitzig and Wundt, acknowledged are perhaps up for revision. We certainly know a great deal more about the structure of the brain, about the communication among neurons, about the physical constituents of those experiences we call a thought, a sensation, a memory. A great deal of explanation has occurred and amassed results quite distinct from those we might have arrived at by interpretation. The sciences of the brain are today better able to challenge the sciences of the mind than were their predecessors of 1883. If the humanities simply fail to engage with this work, characterizing it as based on misconceptions of the inner life, the sovereignty they claim will sooner or later begin to ring hollow. We would isolate ourselves in a Luddite epistemological trap. Another way of putting this, somewhat anxiously, is to say that with his architectonic of the various sciences, Diltai bought us humanists and social scientists some time, but the longer the clock runs, the narrower our margin of autonomy becomes. Our kingdom of interpretation is surrounded by explanation. An explanation does not necessarily care that we measure it against interpretation and find it wanting. A nice expression of this attitude may be found toward the end of Daniel Dennett's Explaining Consciousness, where he says that physicalistic explanations of mental phenomena always explain something away and neglect the thing that matters most. And he says, but of course there always has to be some leaving out, otherwise we wouldn't have begun to explain. Leaving something out is not a feature of failed explanations, but of successful explanations. Right? So that's the voice from the side of explanation. If we recognize, as a matter of recurring historical pattern, that the humanities seem fated to assert themselves against determinism, theological determinism in the early modern period, biological determinism in the age of Diltai, economic determinism in the salad days of Marxism, and every other attempt to assert a heteronomous covering law that puts the real authority in the hands of some other science or superstition, then one way of doing humanities otherwise that opens up is to try to put our discourse in a different relation to determinism. That is what I see at work in Diltai's contemporary Nietzsche every time he invokes physiology as a model for the investigation of morals and values. I'll quote here from the Genealogy of Morals, where Nietzsche says, "Indeed, every table of values, every thou shalt known to history or the study of ethnology, needs first and foremost a physiological elucidation and interpretation rather than a psychological one, and all of them await critical study from medical science. Something, for example, which obviously had value with regard to the longest possible lifespan of a race, or to the improvement of its abilities to adapt to a particular climate, or to maintaining the greatest number, would not have anything like the same value if it was a question of developing a stronger type." End of quotation, and I think you begin to see the problem. Nietzsche's use of physiology is mainly rhetorical, it seems to me, and metaphorical. A card pulled out to trump the claims of the moral sciences or Geisteswissenschaften with the pseudo-certainties of biology and eugenics. But even if it is largely a bluff, the term points to a missing approach to the discussion of matters of value and identity, an approach that does not discuss them in terms of the special sphere of human aspiration and sovereignty, but considers them as the behavior and functions of human animals subject to the constraints of physics and biology. The physiological model allows Nietzsche to frame the self as the outcome of conflicts and alliances among physiological drives occurring below the level of awareness. It also allows him to transfer the physiological language to the superhuman scale of races and tribes. For example, the Genealogy of Morals offers that, to quote, "From time to time, at certain places on Earth, almost from necessity, a physiological feeling of obstruction will rule among large masses of people, which, however, is not consciously perceived as such through lack of physiological knowledge. so that its cause and its cure can be sought and tested only on the psychological moral level. Actually, this is my most general formula for what is usually called a religion. Such a feeling of obstruction can be of the most diverse descent. For example, as a result of crossing races, which are too heterogeneous. Or it could be brought about by unsound emigration, or by the after effects of a race's age and fatigue, or by a faulty diet. Thus far, Nietzsche. The results of the expansion of the term physiology point to a lesson, not necessarily the one Nietzsche intended, that we don't know how to reason morally outside the dimensions of the self. On the level of the organism, physiology neutralizes the language of good and evil and speaks only of such outcomes as survival value and adaptation. On the broader scale, it legitimates the language of race vitalism that subsequent history has discredited in a vivid enough manner. Looking back to Diltai for a contrast, I surmise that the model of the humanities as disciplines based on interpretation and understanding has served us well because it fits nicely with the presuppositions of liberal democratic society. Whether ultimately being one of those words useful for buying time, whether ultimately consciousness reduces to physical events or not, whether or not we have free will, we do, in political contexts we consider normal and normative, treat each other as having sovereignty over ourselves, over our thoughts, and free will to determine our actions. We agree that the only way to know what our fellow human is thinking is to examine his or her words and actions and interpret them, rather than break into the other person's brain and seize the flickering neuron that corresponds to a memory or a personality trait. We like to think of collective decisions as a matter of consent from above, consent from below, even if sometimes grudging consent and not of force majeure from above. Sorry, I skipped a line there in obviously Freudian manner. There's a tyrant screaming to get out from me. To live otherwise than in a perpetual condition of scandal, it is good to restrict one's purview to a small set of familiar and comfortable societies in which the ground rules I just evoked might hold. One can imagine technological changes that would result in a very different articulation of social relations. Some of these may be underway. A neuroscience that was mature enough to predict human behavior would open the way to cruder, more direct manipulations of consent than we observe today. Direct access to others' thoughts, whatever that would mean, would transform the notion of privately held opinion and its public expression. And successful genetic manipulation of future generations would drastically weaken the notion of a human right by accentuating the dependency of the human organism on some other prior agency or authority. These developments fall under what Foucault in his last years called biopower, the power to determine who lives and who dies, and they imply deep changes in the notion of the human subject. The dependency of the humanities on the generosity of strangers, of which we have been reminded in recent months, leaves plenty of room for anxious imaginings of epistemological takeovers yet to come and predictions of the phasing out of the liberal subject. But let us not sink into a siege mentality. Making a case for one or another kind of determinism in order to draw up a pattern for a less purely humanistic human subject, this has been the paradoxical task of many movements in the humanities over the last 100 years, and a job still worth doing. Just to review the history of my own discipline, literary studies, the formalists passed over authors as the main creators of literary texts and put in their place devices, codes, genres, and parallel series of determinants. Milman Perry found patterns of recurrence in Greek epic that served not the expressive intent of an individual author, but the regularity of a shared poetic language. The structuralist dreamt of discovering a grammar of the human mind that would eventually connect myths and music with the sciences of matter and motion. Media theorists found the content of works to be the product of a relation among physical support, technology, audience, and prior media. Philosophers of technology teach us that our most intimate faculties are as much out there as within ourselves. And let us not forget the curious case of psychoanalysis, which began as a branch of physicalistic medical science and has come to rest as one of the interpretive humanities, but one which does not take the self-aware subject as the frame of reference. Each of these perspectives has been won against and despite the hermeneutic method of starting with a subject and an intention. Analogous possibilities are before us today. The research into perception and memory that descends from those early investigations of Hitzig and Wundt and others links up with these traditions, it seems to me, in that each of them shows the strangeness of the human cognitive equipment, its strangeness to us, its users, the ways it does not particularly serve or adhere to the purposes people attempt to carry out using them. I find the most interesting combinations of humanistic subject matter and natural science methods so far in studies of visual response and art. Here, the constructedness of perception is at the fore, and the opportunities for designing experiments that will confound expectations are many. It may be that the whole history of film, again to cite Michael Wood, is such an experiment. Of course, not all research framed in the style of natural science explanation is equally good. Sociobiology, if I may be blunt, seems to me a collection of just-so stories. The kind of genetic or neurological research announced in the newspapers that aspires to find the gene or the neuron responsible for this or that kind of behavior displays a simple kind of materialist essentialism with an obvious determinist bent. But crude efforts such as these should encounter a response, not just a rejection, from the side of the humanities. If my sketch of the relation between interpretation and explanation within the 20th century humanities holds water, it would seem that it is by incorporating naturalistic projects that the humanities make progress, not by insisting on the primacy of the human subject, but by elaborating new accounts of the human subject, limited and augmented by natural constraints, technological affixes, and social structures. In the years since Diltai, we have come increasingly to understand ourselves as assemblages and hybrids. The humanities have been a forum for testing the definition of the human, for modifying it and experimenting with it in response to the natural sciences and their technological offshoots. The subject on which the Geisteswissenschaften was founded no longer has currency, not even, I think, as a normative ideal, because we have been forced to do again and again what Diltai did not do, that is, address the possibility that the deterministic natural science account of our consciousness and free will is the right one. I expect that we will go on confronting that at first view unfriendly perspective, deriving from our awareness of discrepant explanatory and interpretive frameworks the power to critique and propose alternative formulations of the human. Thank you.